If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble. With exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today we've got a bonus podcast to reflect the current debate about statues and reassessing historical figures that's unfolding in the news. With recent protests from the Black Lives Matter movement, attention has been focused on many historical figures and their involvement in the slave trade. One figure who is coming under interrogation is Sir Francis Drake. BBC History Magazine content director Dave Musgrove called Professor Claire Jowett of the University of East Anglia to talk about Drake, his life, times and reputation. Professor Jowett has also written a feature on this topic, which you can find on our website at historyextra.com/Francis-Drake-slavery.
Sir Francis Drake is one of the most famous figures in English history. Elizabethan explorer and global circumnavigator, hero of the Armada, famously insouciant lawn green bowler, pirate and slave trader. And it's the latter part of his career that is exciting interest at the moment, with calls for his statue on the Hoe at Plymouth and in his birthplace of Tavistock to be removed. There's a petition about it, and the petition, the opening sentence of the petition reads, Francis Drake and his cousin John Hawkins were not only slave traders, but pioneers of the British slave trade. So it's time to have a think about Drake and indeed John Hawkins were involved in this trade and how their activities fitted into the wider Elizabethan and early modern age. So I'm joined by Professor Claire Jowett from the University of East Anglia, who is an expert on early modern maritime culture, and she's written a lot about pirates and piracy. She's been on the podcast before, and she's written for BBC History Magazine in the past about Tudor pirates and privateers. She's author of many books and articles, but her most recent work is a collection of 24 essays, The Routledge Companion to Marine and Maritime Worlds, 1400 to 1800, which is co-edited with Craig Lambert and Steve Mentz, and is just out or will be out very soon?
It's out in ebook, and the published version will be available next month in all good bookstores.
Okay, so in July 2020 this will be out. Okay, so Claire, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, thank you.
Okay, so can we start off with a quick potted history of Sir Francis Drake. Who was he? What's he most famous for? And how did he get involved in the slave trade?
Of course. And I think your top line was really very informative. I think that's exactly right. The Oxford Dictionary of National Biography describes him as a pirate, a sea captain and an explorer, but that his activities as a slave trader are also absolutely fundamental to his career. He was born in 1540 to a yeoman family, but was well connected to the maritime families of Devon, and through that established his career at sea, and famously, of course, was involved in the Armada crisis of 1588. But before that, he was only the second man to successfully circumnavigate the globe and the first English man to do that. So that's really what he's most known for, and of course for the major amounts of treasure that he stole as a pirate and as a privateer from Spain, the superpower of the day.
And so what about the slave trading aspect then?
Well, this is very much part of his early career. He is involved in at least three big voyages to the west coast of Africa with his kinsman, Sir John Hawkins. Through those activities, he is part of the first British slave trading ventures, and that's part of a trade triangle where English exports are circulated. So slaves are captured on West Africa. Those slaves are then shipped as cargo to the New World, and then treasure and other goods, hides, are taken back to Europe. So it's a violent, bloody, awful part of English imperial and colonial history.
And so we've talked about Sir John Hawkins a couple of times there. We should say a bit more about him. Who was he, and how does he sort of connect with Drake?
Well, Hawkins' family are, as I say, a prominent maritime family of the West Country. William Hawkins, John's father, was a prominent Plymouth merchant and a ship owner, and he is the first Englishman to establish that triangular transatlantic trade. So 30 years before John Hawkins and Drake are involved in the slave trade, William Hawkins is part of this transatlantic trade between England and West Africa and Brazil. And he's trading goods such as cloth, hatchets, knives, lead, combs, for ivory and gold and pepper in Africa. And then on the return voyages, crossing the Atlantic to the coast of Brazil, where he's buying local produce, including a very valuable commodity of the time, Brazil wood, which is used in the dyeing industry. And this is a really lucrative trade in the 1530s. But Brazil is owned by Portugal in this period of history. So it is an illegal, piratical trade that William Hawkins, John's father, is involved in. And the family are very much, adventurers, swashbucklers, but violent and prepared to take risks to make money.
Okay, so the transatlantic slave trade that develops Hawkins, Sir John Hawkins and Drake become involved with, that is actually born out of a non-slave-based maritime trading culture.
In England it is, but other European nation states, in particular the Portuguese, have, by the point in history that William Hawkins is undertaking a transatlantic trade, have a very well-established slaving trade, where after Henry the Navigator of Portugal sails down the coast of Africa in the 15th century, the Pope, it's Pope Nicholas V, gives Portugal the rights to trade for slaves in West Africa as long as all those slaves are converted to Catholicism. So that trade is fully up and running from the mid-15th century onwards, and very lucrative for Portugal. So that's how labour is supplied to Brazil for the Portuguese, but also slave markets of Lisbon become the point where other European colonial nations, primarily the Spanish, start to buy the slaves that they need for their colonial activities in other parts of the Spanish Main and the West Indies.
Okay, so the trade is established. England becomes involved via Hawkins and others, but England is not presumably a big player in this transatlantic slave trade in the 16th century.
That's exactly right. England is not a big player in colonial or imperial history in the 16th century, but it's ambitious to become so. After the Pope donated through the Treaty of Tordesillas in the late 15th century, both the supposedly newly discovered New World of America and other yet-to-be-discovered regions to the Iberian nations. They were split between Spain and Portugal. The northern European nations who were excluded from that donation were competitively determined through actions like piracy to get their sort of stake within the colonial and imperial wealth that was coming from that new world and other distant regions. And of course, the bullion in particular that was coming from South America was crucial to activities across Europe, because it made the countries that got that bullion immensely powerful. They could fight war at home on a different scale from countries that didn't benefit from those levels of resourcing.
Okay. So Sir John Hawkins and Drake sort of hook into this existing network. And I suppose, obviously, the transatlantic slave trade and the people involved in that, that's abhorrent to us today. It's a nefarious practice. But clearly, there are people at either end of that trade as well, supplying the slaves and buying the slaves. So we've got people, I don't know how they're acquiring the slaves in Africa, and I don't know who they are selling them to at their end destination.
Okay. There are a number of slave traders that become established down the west coast of Africa, the Portuguese. It also involves some indigenous groups. There have been war between indigenous groups on the west coast of Africa. The slave traders take advantage of that because obviously there are captives from war that are then sold to the slave traders. And what Drake and Hawkins do is a mixture of hunting black West Africans, hunting them down, destroying their villages, murdering and treating people absolutely terribly, extraordinarily violent kind of behaviours, and also trading with the Portuguese that have got a system themselves of capturing people. And what's quite interesting within those kind of dynamics is that the Portuguese traders are officially banned from trading with interlopers such as Drake and Hawkins. But so When they say that Drake and Hawkins have attacked them and stolen their cargoes, that may very well be true, but it also may be a ruse so that to their authorities, they don't look like they've been colluding with the enemy.
Okay. So it's a complicated picture here with some different things going on. I'm just wondering, just in terms of shipping, of actually getting the ships and their cargo, their human cargo, across the sea. I have a view of Tudor sailing ships of not being enormously big. Perhaps I'm wrong about that, but we're talking quite a few people being crammed onto these ships. So presumably it's an extremely unpleasant experience.
Yes, absolutely. It's the conditions in which people are transported are truly horrific. A number will die on the journey. People are treated as cargo, simply as merchandise to be transported as cheaply and as quickly as possible to the destinations in the New World, where just as there is a complicated picture when the slaves are captured and enslaved in Africa, there's also quite a complicated picture about how the human contents of these ships are merchandised and sold within the New World, that colonists there really need the labour that West African slaves provide, because within the Caribbean, by the turn of the 16th century, within South America, indigenous populations in America are decimated both by the atrocious treatment that conquerors and conquistadors have meted out to them, but also, of course, from invisible bullets, from the European and indeed African diseases against which they had no immunity. So there's a real need for labour within colonial terrains though again, someone like Hawkins or Drake should not be traded with by the Iberians, and they might have to make it look like they've been forced to make those trades. It's very likely that actually that again is a camouflage, a smokescreen.
Okay, so Drake and Hawkins must have been pretty, for all the unpleasantness of what they did, they must have been pretty canny, wily operators to make this a success. So they did the three voyages. Were all those the three journeys that they did, were they all successful commercially? Did they achieve what they set out to do?
Yes. I think the profits to be garnered here were immense. So even when, in financial terms, things went wrong, Hawkins overreaches himself on some occasions. So on the first slaving voyage, not only does he send back the three English ships that he has back to England, loaded with money and treasure and hides, but he tries to break in legitimately to this trade monopoly that the Iberians have got by sending extra ships to one to Seville, one to Lisbon, and those ships are seized. And he later says that this costs him £20,000, but nevertheless, even with that loss, this is a very lucrative voyage. On the third voyage, this is the last voyage, and this is when the Spanish in what is now Mexico attack Hawkins and Drake's ships, and only two of the ships manage to return from this third voyage. But nevertheless, even then, with a major loss, in terms of the ships and the amount of bullion they're capturing that they've got, that still makes a profit.
And the profits they made, as you pointed out just then, were sizable enough to attract the attention of of the Queen, Queen Elizabeth, and her courtiers back in London. So what do we know of what the Elizabethan state thought about this activity? And I think it's quite interesting that you've written a piece for the website about this, and you talk about the fact that Queen Elizabeth and Dudley, Robert Dudley, her favourite for much of her reign, the Earl of Leicester, were active backers, shareholders even, in this enterprise.
That's right. Because the profits from the first voyage were so spectacular, you're quite right, this is what attracts the attention of the most prominent men and women in England at the time. And the Queen gives or allows Hawkins to lease a ship, the Jesus of Lübeck, from her. And also he is allowed to fly the Royal Standard on the voyage. So it's a real mark that that this voyage is absolutely central to the foreign policy of Elizabethan England. Not only were the most prominent courtiers involved with it, but William Cecil, Secretary of State, is clearly involved in overseeing the kind of activities and organisation behind the scenes of this, the second and indeed the third voyage.
And sorry, this question just occurs to me. Does that mean that Queen Elizabeth I and her court should be tarred with the same brush as Drake in terms of being slave traders, or is that going too far?
No, I think that's absolutely right. Early modern Elizabethan men and women were not offended by the idea of the slave trade. They believed, by and large, that enslaving with this idea of conversion was imbuing the enslaved people with everlasting life, access to the kingdom of heaven, and therefore that justified the loss of their land, their freedom, their livelihoods, because that exchange was giving them something that would last for eternity, whereas it was just a temporal exchange that the enslaved people were giving.
I mean, that's a very interesting point of view, isn't it? A very interesting observation you make there, that they were basically justifying this through means of Christianity. Do you think, it's probably very hard to tell this from the documents, do you think they believed that, or was that a justification for something that they believed to be morally incorrect?
I think you're right. It's very difficult to say on a case-by-case basis. Certainly, as part of Drake's mythography, his Protestantism was something that he actively wanted to be worked into that view of himself. But there is no particular evidence that he was a highly, you know, religious man. It appears, for the most part, that religion is being used for business, effectively, within both Drake and Hawkins. They have a flexible attitude to religion. Hawkins, for instance, when he's trading in the 1550s in the Canary Islands, which are controlled by Spain, that's in the Malmsey, the sweet wine trade, is reported to be very comfortable attending mass because that oils the wheels of commerce. And yet he is a Protestant.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
The sick day products of the bloody and violent 16th century, and they are also creators of a bloody and violent 17th century and 18th century.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
So we talked about the journeys that they did, the free journeys, and the last one having the problems at the end, and then the slave trading activities basically paused after that. That was the last Tudor adventures into this area. Is that right? And how long? Why did people not carry on doing it after that?
The Anglo-Spanish diplomatic relations after the third slaving voyage, where Spain attacked Hawkins's fleet, became part and parcel of that growing demand for an explicit attack on Spanish possessions, rather than a coded attack that the slave trade was making. And England goes to war in 1585, but it's there's an undeclared war in many ways going on much earlier than that. And John Hawkins and Drake, after that experience on the third voyage, are extremely hostile to Spain. Drake leaves, and this causes problems with his relationship with Hawkins. He gets back separately to England from the attack in San Juan de Ula, both of them are furious about the losses that they have sustained, notwithstanding that overall the voyage makes a profit. They see all that they've lost, and they effectively declare war on Spain, you know, years before England formally goes to war. So attention really turns. And then there's the circumnavigation of 1577 to 1580 that Drake leads. And again, that is about attacking the Spanish in the New World in a way that they were not expecting, because by being able to go through the Magellan Straits, Drake is going from the Atlantic into the Pacific, and by being on the Pacific seaboard on these undefended parts of the Spanish Empire, he's able to run amok. And that's how he manages to get so much bullion from that circumnavigation, because it's just not expected. So the focus is on direct attack against Spain rather than the slave trade, which is an attack on Spain, but not in quite such an open way.
Okay, so we've got these free slaving voyages in the 1560s, and then English activity in slave trading doesn't happen again until we get into the 17th century. Is there you're an expert in the whole field of maritime history. Do you see any particular differences between these early examples of slave trading and the more famous later transatlantic slave trade that through which so many lives were horribly altered through the shipping of people from Africa to America?
In scale, yes, but not in terms of the worldview that allows enslavement of others for colonial mercantile advantage. So I think this is truly the origin in Britain of what becomes a major industry and a major part of the building of the British Empire. And these three voyages show how lucrative, but how dangerous and how violent those activities are. So I think they are harbingers of that later huge industrial scale slave trading that Britain takes part in.
So Sir Francis Drake and Sir John Hawkins, they deserve the infamy then of being acknowledged as England's first slave traders. You think that's a justifiable thing to say about them?
Yes, absolutely. But it's not the full story of their lives. But it's a very important part of the sick, they're products of the bloody and violent 16th century, and they are also creators of a bloody and violent 17th century and 18th century.
I mean, the typical refrain is that, you know, if someone has done something which we consider today to be abhorrent, it's that they would be operating within the social norms of the day. They were men of their time. It sounds as if what you're saying is, yes, they were, but perhaps also they went further than others. Is that a fair assessment, or
I think they were. Yes, I think that is a fair assessment. I think they were ambitious. They were men that made things happen, and they are men that at the same time as defended England. And remember, England is a backwater against the might of the superpower of the day, the Spanish Armada, and they were brave, they were resourceful, they are leaders of men, but at the same time, those kinds of qualities also mean that they are instigators in patterns of behaviour that are inhumane and create further inhumanity.
So I think for a lot of people, certainly in England today, this story will be slightly surprising. Maybe not so much now with all the conversation going on, but for a lot of people, Drake is still an unalloyed adventure hero, someone, you know, to be celebrated as a sea captain and explorer, the Armada guy, and even his piratical activities, you know, celebrated to some extent and glorified for their adventurous aspects. So why is that? Why don't we know this story as much as we do? Or maybe we do. Maybe it's just me. I don't think it is.
I don't think it is. Well, I think the 19th century in particular, the great looked for precursors to the attitudes to empire and to expansionism, and found in the Elizabethan sea dogs what they considered to be kindred spirits. So it's no coincidence that many of the statues that are being talked about now, which you mentioned at the top of our discussion, were put up in the 19th century. The 19th century is a time that constructs its vision of the world on great man history. Drake, less so Hawkins, but Drake, with that circumnavigation, and that which is an extraordinary achievement. Drake had an extraordinary life. That's absolutely true. That comes at a terrible, terrible cost. But it's the 19th century in particular that colours, even today, our view of the past.
And is there something peculiar to the national psyche in England and I guess more broadly in Britain about us being an island nation and all that, that means that we give a bit more leeway to the sea dogs, to the maritime heroes?
Yes, I think that's also a view of plucky little Britain, David against the monolithic, monstrous Goliath of the Iberian domination. And it's not just England, though, that is oppositional. It's the other Northern European states as well. So while I think that view of you know, little Englanders is one version, also there is an alliance between Protestants against the Iberians, because of course the 16th century in particular is a century of wars of religion, in particular with the schism with Rome and the Reformation, that the Protestant League, against the Iberians. So there are different stories, there are different narratives at work here, but certainly England's island identity is very much part of that mix.
Okay, last question as we wrap up, and this is a question that may well date very quickly, depending on what happens with these statue discussions, but as an expert in this area, what's your view on whether that statue of Drake, the famous one on Plymouth Hoe overlooking the sea there, whether that should stand?
Thank you for asking me that. I suspect you're right that this will date quickly, but I think it should stay, but I think context and understanding the history in all its violence and its bloodiness should be part and parcel of the way in which Drake and indeed Hawkins are remembered. So at the moment we have in those statues Drake with a globe, Drake with a sword. We have, for instance, the National Portrait Gallery picture of 1581 of Drake, and his hand is on Africa. We need to tell those stories. We need to contextualise them better. We don't want our school children just to think that Drake played a damn good game of bowls. We need to understand what the real dynamic of that 16th century history actually was. So recontextualising statues within museum context, but also actually in the public domain, open for everybody to debate what our history actually was, is very important.
Okay, well, hopefully this podcast will help in some small measure to do that as well. So, Professor Clare Jarrett, thank you so much for your time. As I said, the book that you've just been working on, The Routledge Companion to Marine and Maritime Worlds, 1400 to 1800, is well worth a look. It's got lots of very interesting articles which add a lot of context to the much bigger story there. So worth a look there. And you've written that piece for our website, historyextra.com. So I hope listeners will go there and have a look at that as well. But Clare, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
That was Professor Clare Jowett. The Routledge Companion to Marine and Maritime Worlds, 1400 to 1800, which Claire has co-edited with Craig Lambert and Steve Mentz, will be published soon. You can also read Professor Jowett's feature on Drake and Tudor slavery on our website. You'll find that at historyextra.com/Francis-Drake-slavery. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us next tomorrow when I'll be speaking to David Carpenter about the medieval king, Henry III.